Har du et enkeltpersonforetak eller en liten bedrift? Da du sikkert lei av å høre meg snakke om hvor enkelt det å levere skattemeldingen med fiken. Så vi gir oss her. Fordi vi liker enkelt. Fiken. Superenkelt regnskap.
Velkommen til Ukraina-podden, en podcast fra Nettavisen. Det 701 dager siden Russland eskalerte krigen som startet i 2014, og gikk til en fullskala angrep mot Ukraina. Today, we'll do this in English. As usual, we have Jørn with me. Welcome, Jørn.
Hi, I'm Jørn. I'm a Ukraine columnist for Nettavisen and the leader of the Norwegian-Ukrainian Friendship Association.
And welcome to you, Olena Halushka. Yeah, welcome to us.
Thank you very much. My big pleasure.
Yeah, and you're the leader of the and the co-founder of the International Center for Ukrainian Victory. And
yes.
You're here in Norway for a couple of days.
For 2 days.
Yeah, and what do you want to achieve here? Like, why do you go to Norway?
So our trip to Norway is actually part of the larger European tour. Last week we were in Rome for 3 days, then we moved to Berlin for 2.5 days and spent the rest of the week here. One of the reasons why we are right now traveling across Europe is to talk more about European leadership in supporting Ukraine, in supporting Ukrainian victory, and making sure that Ukraine has sufficient resources to resist and win this war. Because the news and the dynamics of the debate in the US is very worrying. We are seeing that the Congress cannot approve the big $60 billion dollar aid package for Ukraine since September, and the negotiations are ongoing, but there are not much of the optimistic prospects. So it's very important for us to have an adult conversation with our European partners. What is plan B if American aid is not coming? Whether they are ready to step up with the financial aid, with ramping up of the military production and making sure that Russia is defeated in Ukraine.
Yeah, and what kind of responses do you get? Like, do people meet you with a cold shoulder, or do they understand how acute the situation is with the need of weapons and other support to Ukraine?
I have the feeling that people understand the needs. We try to deliver the sense of urgency, to explain that the situation on the battlefield in Ukraine is really dire. And there was a good reporting of CNN a few days ago from the front lines in the east, where they actually said that the level of artillery ammunition use Russia versus Ukraine is something like 10 to 1. This is probably the lowest from Ukraine's side since the beginning of the full-scale war. And we are seeing that Russian missile and drone attacks are also regularly happening. We had the deadliest terrorist attack against Kyiv a few days before the new year. And a few days ago, there was a very big attack against Kharkiv. Kharkiv was attacked 3 times massively in just 1 day. Kyiv is attacked. I'm not even speaking about Kherson. I have the feeling that, you know, it's daily reality to be shelled by whatever Russia has, including the gliding bombs that are super destructive. They are not precise, but if the goal is to terrorize and to bring as much horror as possible, it's not about, you know, the precision weapon. It's about just destruction and the scorched earth tactics. So that's why we convey the sense of urgency that, you know, European Union cannot adopt the EU facility, Ukraine facility package, because Orban blocked it. So they postponed it for 2 months. US is debating the aid. But what we see simultaneously, we see that the coalition, the alliance of autocracies is much better in coordinating, because from the very beginning of the full-scale war, it was Russia alone with Belarus, which is de facto occupied by Russia. Then Iran started supporting them with drones. And now it's Iran supporting them with drones technologies for production of the drones and ballistic missiles. It's North Korea supplying Russia with 1 million rounds of ammunition. The same goal as European Union cannot deliver for Ukraine. It's also North Korea supplying Russia with ballistic missiles. And while the alliance of autocracies is stepping up, you know, Western aid is declining. So that's something which we are conveying to everybody.
So what is it that Ukraine need the most right now? Is there one thing that really would make a difference right now? Like, for example, artillery shells or something else? Or is it like just the whole thing, like you need more of everything?
It's probably, you know, the second option, because unfortunately there is no one wonder weapon that would help us to win this war. But the weapons need to come in time and in sufficient quantities. And in time is also super important, because we advocated for the main battle tanks and fighter jets since the very beginning of the full-scale war. We did not receive them. Fighter jets are still coming. But I mean, tanks arrived in a year and a half, and Russians already managed to build very strong defense lines in the south of Ukraine. And then, you know, people were wondering why counteroffensive is not successful, because Russia was given time to build the defense lines. If the tanks arrived for Kherson counteroffensive and for Kharkiv counteroffensive, then the situation would be way more different and we would be able to liberate much more territory. Or fighter jets. According to the NATO doctrine, ground combat operations start without reaching air superiority. We do not have in Ukraine, you know, even air parity, maybe a weak one. You know, when we were advocating for F-16, we heard very often that you do not need them. It's not the urgent. And another important thing right now is longer range missiles. We received the Storm Shadow and Scalp missiles from the UK and France, but we still cannot get Taurus missiles from Germany and sufficient numbers of American ATACMS. Why? And when we are asking this, and we were asking this in Berlin many times, we didn't get any reasonable answer.
What did they try to tell you?
Same approach as over the previous 2 years, escalation management.
Yeah, and is what does it make you feel to hear that, European countries are afraid of escalation of the war if they give too much weapons to Ukraine? Like, is there any way this could be escalated against Ukraine?
Well, we try to explain that you cannot escalate self-defense. I mean, the only party which is escalating in this war is Russia. And we heard and we were asking partners what will be the response if Russia gets ballistic missiles from Iran and North Korea. And we were promised that this will be a red line and that there will be a very harsh and strong response. And the only response which we see right now is condemnation. Condemnation doesn't stop missiles that are raining on the heads of Ukrainians. You cannot put condemnation into your howitzers and fire with it at the occupiers' forces that are trying to break your defense lines, occupy more Ukraine, and genocide more Ukrainians that are living at home. But that's how it is.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think it's a very important point what you mentioned, that there was an opportunity in late 2022 where the Russian lines were unstable and they were caught off guard with the, especially the Kharkiv offensive. And if they, if Ukraine had had resources to continue to push there, they would have probably liberated more areas, at least in the east. And, the fact that F-16s has been postponed so many times and these glide bombs that you described, there's only one way to stop those glide bombs, and that's range in air-to-air combat. And Western aircraft offers that, and there's nothing else that does that. So it's the West has failed, while the alliance of autocracies, as you call them, has stepped up their game. And the fact that North Korea alone has delivered more artillery shells to Ukraine than to Russia than the West has delivered to Ukraine is depressing. And the biggest supplier of artillery shells to Ukraine is actually South Korea, that has delivered 500,000. But they're not able to continuously provide that much because North Korea is now threatening South Korea. So there's a lot going on different fronts.
Yeah, and you mentioned it, but the EU, European Union, promised to deliver 1 million artillery shells to Ukraine before March this year. And I think in December, the last numbers I saw was 300,000 or 400,000 shells that has already arrived in Ukraine. And I don't think anybody believes anymore that the goal of 1 million shells before March will be accomplished. So just to give you some numbers on, and how the situation is and how much more support the Russians are getting from their allies. And I understand that's important for you to talk about and bring up to your Western allies. But how do you see the situation in the US in the coming months and this year? Like, they can't agree with themselves in the Congress, and we might get another term with Donald Trump in the White House. And how do you think that could affect Ukraine?
I think that it's very important that European Union builds it, and European partners, obviously Norway, UK, build own European strategy towards Russia. And it is absolutely great to have US on our side helping us a lot. But this war is existential war, not only for Ukraine, but for entire European continent because of geography. And in case if Ukraine fails, Russia is very clear. They are very explicitly threatening to attack other countries, including the countries that are NATO members, like Baltic states or, you know, Poland, or even Finland. So we have to make sure that Europe is not defenseless. We have to make sure that Europe has sufficient military production, industries, because you said that there is this issue, yes, with 1 million artillery shells. We know about that, and we, of course, try to speed up this process and advocate, ask for more. But we also understand that there are some bottlenecks with regards to the production. So things like that have to be addressed, and more investment needs to be done, more guarantees, you know, from the government for the businesses that this is not a short-term commitment, but Ukraine needs sufficient weapons, not only to fight this war, but also to deter any future aggressions after the war ends and ends with victory. We hope, we ask, we call partners to support, and Europe needs to fill in the stocks to make sure that in any case, you know, sufficient arsenal is the only thing that can deter aggressions and larger war.
Yeah, and Norway just announced 2 weeks ago that we would ramp up the artillery production. Finland has done the same just before Christmas, I think. And I think there's some news from Sweden as well.
Yeah.
But is it too late?
No, of course, much better late than never. And here I would like to particularly thank to our Nordic partners, because you are stepping up and you're doing a lot. And Norway is doing a lot, Sweden, Finland, Denmark as well. And it's important that these things are happening, because Russia is preparing for the long war. Russia is preparing to fight for years. And Russia, as an autocracy, can afford cutting any social expenses, healthcare, educational, and channel everything for their war budget. So for 2024, they actually increased their war budget by 70%. So this ramping up of production is critical. And we also talked to France, and they are also ramping up production. We speak to Germany. There's a big interest on the side of industries to do that. More reliance from the side of the government, unfortunately, but even there, very important processes are being done. Like, for example, they restarted the production of the ammunition for Gepard air defense systems, particularly for Ukraine, and that's something which helps us to protect our peaceful towns from Russian aggression. And so many important things and processes are happening, but pretty slowly.
Yeah, but what does a Ukrainian victory looks like? Is that a question you can try to answer?
I think that it's very important to answer this question, because when you advocate for something, obviously partners want to understand what. And we even made a research, a sociological poll, asking Ukrainians how they see victory. And they see victory as, first of all, full restoration of Ukrainian borders. So Ukrainians won't compromise territories for so-called peace. And I highlight so-called because this is just a temporary peace. Anything short of Ukrainian victory would not be sustainable. So we have to regain control over entire territory. And Crimea is just the same territory of Ukraine as Kyiv and Lviv. And when people say that we should give up on Crimea, from the international law perspective, you know, from the rules-based world order, why should Ukraine give up on our territory? But not only military victory, it's about accountability. And Russia has to pay reparations, including by the confiscated assets, but not only, because the damages significantly exceed the assets that are frozen currently. That's justice tribunal for the Russian aggression and convictions of the top political leadership of Russia, plus EU and NATO integration as the economic and security guarantees to make sure that Ukraine will be reconstructed, people and migrants can return home, and we would be able to finalize our rule of law reforms to make sure that our democracy is truly strong and vibrant.
Some critics would maybe say that this is a leading question, but how were your experiences with the Minsk Accords? How effective was those peace treaties?
Because a lot of people on the internet likes to say that, oh, Ukraine didn't respect the Minsk Accords, and we had good peace deals between the so-called republics and Ukraine, but they were not followed up by the Ukrainian side. So
it's an absolute manipulation, because the only party which violated Minsk deal is Russia, and they have been had been violating it very regularly and constantly. And I think that the experience with Minsk deals is actually, unfortunately, a very bitter example in practice why Russia is not interested in peace, why Russia is not interested in deals. Russia is interested only in subjugating, conquering Ukraine. In case if they realize they cannot conquer Ukraine now, they need time out to rearm, to train more military personnel, and then, you know, try to capture more of Ukraine at the next stage of the war. And Minsk agreements, which Ukraine signed in 2014, the first one, in 2015, the second one, they didn't bring peace. They brought genocide, which started in 2022. That's Russian real face.
Yeah, and I think also it's kind of goes into the line of deals with Russia that it's like you can't trust them. Like you had
Budapest memorandum.
Yeah, Budapest memorandum. excuse my tongue. Budapest memorandum. Okay.
Budapest memorandum.
Thank you. And yeah, I'll have the
just mean, point every time you need help with.
Yeah,
with
if I point and you just say the word. Yeah. Yeah, the Budapest
memorandum.
Thank you. And the Minsk agreements and. If all of them were followed according to the agreements, we would not be where we were today, right?
Yes, absolutely. And there is even a more recent, very good example about Russia and deals, which is grain deal. Russia actually, you know, denied the freedom of navigation in the Black Sea from the very beginning of the full-scale war. And then there was this grain deal signed in order to kind of let Ukrainian grain be exported through the Black Sea. But Russia kind of, you know, distracted the work of the deal. They were blocking the passage of vessels. You know, they were inspecting them artificially much longer than they had to be. So the number of ships that could use this grain deal corridor was very low. But then, you know, in 2023, Ukraine managed to show some very good results in the Black Sea, pushing Russian fleet much further away from Odessa region and from that part of the coast. And basically, we introduced our own grain deal corridor, you know, with guarded by Ukrainian defenses. And all of a sudden, this Ukrainian freedom, imposed freedom of navigation corridor is much more successful, because over 4 months, more ships and vessels managed to use it successfully than over the 1 year of work of Russian grain deal. So that's something which shows that any deal Russia tries to abuse for their own interest, they always blackmail to get much more benefits. You remember that when they withdrew from the grain deal, they blackmailed the UN that sanctions should be lifted and some additional preferences like insurance for their ships should be introduced. And Secretary General of the UN actually was pretty ready to move forward with the Russian demands. But, you know, half a year afterwards, we are seeing that the best grain deal is Ukraine, armed to teeth and capable of defending itself and securing freedom of navigation in the Black Sea.
Mm. Another topic that's been talked about by some people is that the people in, for example, Donetsk, Luhansk, and Crimea, do they really want to go back to Ukraine? Like, what if, like, maybe isn't they like more friendly to Russia than the rest of the country? And what would you answer to to that?
First of all, that is Russian propaganda, because if you take a look at the results of the referendum for independence in 1991, there was an absolute majority in all of the regions of the country voting for the independence, including in Crimea. Since 2014, Russia has made a very aggressive policy of destroying any resistance and bringing actual real Russians, Russian nationals, into those territories. For example, the population of Crimea before 2014 was, I think, 1.5 million, something like that. And since 2014, they actually moved into peninsula 800,000 Russians. Like, you know, and when somebody says, let's ask people of Crimea whether they want to be Ukraine or Russia, whom to ask? 800,000 Russians that were illegally moved into Crimea. I mean, while people with very pro-Ukrainian stance were put into prisons, you know, tortured, killed, abducted, many were forced to flee simply because, you know, they were facing the death threats. And if we speak about Donetsk, there is a very infamous torture prison, Izolyatsiya, very similar, where introduced in many other occupied territories after 2022. But Izolyatsiya was working since 2014, and Russians there kind of, you know, tested a lot of Stalin type tortures and, you know, tactics of breaking resistance. And I mean, what has been happening in the occupied territories since 2014 has been, you know, a very aggressive policy of destroying anything Ukraine related. And after 2022, it's full scale, absolute genocide. I mean, the news, I still follow a lot the news from Mariupol, which break my heart very much, because after erasing this town from the earth, you know, those kids that still stay in the destroyed ghost town, they are brainwashed in the schools. Ukrainian books are destroyed. You know, they hear every day in the school that it was Ukrainian army who was killing them. You know, why all of a sudden Ukrainian army, which was defending them before, you know, February 24, 2022, would bomb Mariupol? But, you know, when you are hearing things like that for 10 years, for 20 years, obviously, you know, at a certain point, some people might start believing those propaganda narratives. And that's also one of the arguments why we are pushing, you know, to liberate all of the territories, because the longer they stay under occupation, the more detrimental, damaging, you know, policies, the more genocide Russia would be able to implement there. Or take a look at the deportation and abduction of kids. They are taking Ukrainian kids and putting them into Russian families, where they are brainwashed into hating Ukrainians. And then, you know, in 5 to 10 to 15 years, they will be sent to kill Ukrainians again because of this hatred.
Yeah, and we've already seen some examples of that, I think. Like, there was an 18-year-old boy or man, I think just around Christmas, that he was taken to Russia against his will, and then he was summoned to the army.
Well, fortunately, this case was fixed, and he was returned to Ukraine. Yeah. But that just shows that it will soon become a tendency.
Yeah, like, it's just not something you say, like, it's actually already kind of happening already, just to make clear that it's a real thing.
And when we speak about the number of Ukrainians killed in the war, one group that is often forgotten is the men in the areas that has been occupied from 2014, that has been forcefully mobilized in this war by the Russians and forced to fight their countrymen at the front. And they have very high casualty numbers. It's the same as during World War II and from other republics in Russia, that they are quite comfortable with them having high casualty numbers, because when you're when you want to swap the population, then that doesn't matter. Like the, like you said, moving in 800,000 settlers, moving in settlers in occupied territory is a breach of international law. So it's a very, very comprehensive argument of why we can't allow Russia to just keep these areas.
Yeah, and something you're also working on is to seize Russian assets, because when the full-scale invasion started, I think the West like froze $300 billion, which is something like 3,000 kroner, isn't it like that? Or more, it's 3,000 billion kroners. It's like a huge amount of money, and that's seized by the West. And there's been talks about giving those money to Ukraine for a long time, but I think it has kind of come more on the agenda the last weeks. And why is that important?
That is super important, because, you know, while we are expecting the European package, American package of assistance to come, we see that this is not sustainable. And we realized from the very beginning that in the protracted war, it would be much more complicated for Ukraine to win, because we are a much smaller country. Our mobilization potential is smaller. Our economy is being targeted. And in the first year of the full-scale war, we lost 30% of our GDP. That's a lot. And Russian missiles and drones continue targeting our enterprises, companies, businesses across the entire country. Big part of the working population, particularly women, were forced to flee the country with the kids, and they are currently staying abroad. So our demographical situation is very, very complicated. And the delays in the weapons supplies, in ramping up the capacities of the industries, again lead to us defending our right to exist with the lives of our best people, which could have been avoided if we received sufficient assistance in time. So while it's getting more complicated to pool Western assistance for Ukraine, the West sits at Russian $300 billion, which belonged to Ukraine, and it was even recognized by G7 in their recent statement, where they said that they would not return this money to Russia until the reparations are paid. So do we expect Russia to pay voluntarily reparations? Obviously not, meaning that some additional, force should be imposed on them for that. But while this money just lies dead and waits for the end of the war, we might lose Ukraine, and there might be no country to pay reparations for. And there might be, tens of millions of new refugees, which will be the burden for Europe, European countries, because people already know what does it mean to live under the Russian occupation. So we are not ready to wait to get this money somewhere in the distant future, but we need them now, and we advocate for the confiscation of those assets and transferring them for Ukraine, and not only for the Ukrainian recovery, but also for the military production and for the compensation for the victims of the Russian aggression, because that's the just and the right thing to do. And the momentum indeed is here, particularly because many think that in the protracted war, that should be a kind of a sustainable and secured basket of assistance for Ukraine. But we still need to push for that because within G7, let's say, we have the US, UK, Canada that are more in favor of this idea. And we have European part plus Japan that are pretty reluctant. So most of the efforts right now should focus at convincing European partners.
Yeah. And how do you see the way forward to seizing those funds? Because I know it was a topic on the economic forum in Davos, you know, Bill Browder, like Putin's big nemesis, if you can, if you have something close to that, he advocated for the seizing the funds there. And I know like you're working on that, but how, like, what's the way forward?
Yes. Bill Browder has been a very strong and good advocate for this idea for a long time. And we are very grateful to him for that. Actually, the lawyers, and mostly American, but also in cooperation with European legal scholars, they made a very solid argument and analysis explaining why that would not contradict the international law. And on the contrary, it would be absolutely lawful. What do they offer? They offer to confiscate this money as the countermeasures doctrine. What is countermeasures? Countermeasures, that's the lawful actions of the countries that are responding towards the violations by an aggressor with the aim to stop, to make them stop these violations. And the countermeasures have to be proportionate and they have to be reversible. And that's, you know, where the key discussion goes on. Because if in terms of a proportionate, everybody agrees that, you know, we are speaking about $300 billion of frozen assets and damages of the first year of the full-scale war already exceed $400 billion, meaning that it's not proportionate, but, you know, in the other way around, that it's much smaller than actually the damages. But then, you know, people say that if you confiscate, it can't be reversible. But that's not entirely true because Russian international obligations are not only to stop the war and to withdraw their forces from Ukraine, but also pay the reparations. And here we come back to the fact that the frozen asset is much less than the actual damages. So what is offered is to, when Russia agrees to pay the reparations, this amount of the confiscated money would be offset from the due payment of the reparations. And that would actually make this act reversible.
Yeah. And do you think it could happen already this year, that Ukraine would get those money?
Well, we hope so. We are pushing. But to be honest, I think that it's an endeavor for a year. And that's why we are, you know, simultaneously campaigning to make sure that we have other resources, that in case if American funds are not coming, then, you know, Europe can provide us with sufficient resources to make sure that Ukraine does not need anything by the moment when this confiscation is made.
Yeah. And also, I'm going to go to one of our listeners. He sent us a mail, like we have this listener questions, and he sent us a mail a couple of weeks ago, and he asked us if we think that Putin now regrets starting the full-scale invasion. Do you think the people in the Kremlin and Putin himself kind of regrets their decision?
I can only speculate, but I think that he doesn't. Why? Because the reading of the authoritarian dictators of the situation is that you can outlast and you can outplay the West. Meaning that if you want to get something by force, The initial response will be shocking, that's for sure. Putin was not expecting the sanctions, you know, a military aid for Ukraine. But then he put the bet on Ukraine fatigue, and that's what the propaganda is also trying to fuel. And if Western aid for Ukraine is not coming, then the dictators make the conclusion that you have to first endure this, you know, inconveniences. But then if you manage, you know, to withstand, it's all yours. And you can achieve by force whatever you want to on the international arena. And basically what Iran is right now doing in the Middle East with the hands of their proxies is continuation of this global war of autocracies against democracies. The fact that North Korea is preparing for the renewal of the war, military actions, attacks against South Korea is also part of this global, you know, it's not a competition, it's an aggression. It's an aggressive attempt to change the rules-based world order for the force-based rule order, where anything, you know, the including the borders of sovereign states can be changed by force. And the fact, you know, that China may also attack Taiwan would be a very, you know, kind of a logical sequence of actions. So maybe even if Putin regretted at the very beginning, I think at this point he is pretty delighted with the dynamics of the events. And that's also a wake-up call that we are delivering to our partners, that in case if Putin succeeds in Ukraine, he won't stop, because he sees the West's weakness. And the West's weakness is that the West is not ready to stand for the cause, for values, for sovereignty, for rules-based order fully. And till the very end.
Thanks. And if, well, when your organization has accomplished its goals and Ukraine has won, I think a lot of our listeners would like to go to Ukraine. Is there like one place they like, which is a must see?
Well, I think that obviously must see is our Crimea, because it is. Besides, it has a very strategic location. It is incredibly beautiful. And I would encourage everybody to Google the pictures, because there's very beautiful sea, rocky mountains, and the nature there is literally one of the best I've ever seen in the world. And that would definitely be, I mean, Russia turned Crimea into a military base. We will return to Crimea, it's tourism, you know, the sightseeing, and kind of the place to welcome the guests from all over the world. And we will be, after the victory, we would be very happy, of course, to have all of these amazing people that are supporting Ukraine from everywhere, who continue demanding from the governments for more military aid, for more sanctions, to support Ukrainian victory. And this will be our joint victory. But unfortunately, today, I have the feeling that we are getting further away from this victory. So Europe has to be much more serious, with a serious commitment, step up. And this war is still winnable. General Zaluzhny, in his article, explained very, very well what needs technology. And Norway is excellent in technologies. Your technologies are incredibly important for our war and self-defense. And I'm sure that we still have time and momentum to make sure that this war is winnable, but we have to step up and do much more.
Yeah. Do you think Ukraine can go on the offensive again this year? Or do you think like you need a year off the offensive to kind of regroup, retrain, get more equipment? Or
there will be likely a full mobilization in the next couple of months, and those people would need training, plus we would need to improve some capacities. So I would not, you know, speculate about the plans for the counteroffensive, because I think that it was also one of the mistakes of 2023, that there was a very big pressure from the international partners that Ukraine has to do a counteroffensive. But one of the reasons why Kherson and Kharkiv counteroffensives were so successful, because they were surprising, they were very well planned, and Russians didn't have enough time to dig in. Right now, we are seeing that, you know, this competitive advantage is already lost. So our lives, our people, is Ukraine's best and biggest asset. We cannot afford throwing them into counteroffensive, which where we do not have, you know, the guarantees for success. So I think that more technology, more jamming system, more drones, that would be something, you know. Hopefully F-16 is coming in the next few months, and with all those capacities and finally having much more air superiority, after that it would be more clear on how to move forward.
Yeah. And I think the last question is if you would share how your February 24th, 2022 was. Like, where were you?
I was in Ukraine. I was in Lviv. And, well, for me, it was very obvious. I knew that the big war was coming, and I was following all those, you know, Western intelligence reporting since October, when the new build up was Russians were doing at the Ukrainian border. So I was expecting. I remember that night I was checking news permanently, because 2 days before Putin gave his speech where he, by the way, mentioned all of Ukrainian reforms, our anti-corruption institutions, our judicial reform with the international participation. So for us, that was a sign that the decision is already made, and that successful democratic Ukraine and everything which we have been building since 2014 is the real threat. That's something which scares Putin to death. So for me personally, that was just a matter of time when this will start. And yeah.
Yeah. So thank you so much for coming and sharing your thoughts with our listeners. And I wish you a safe trip back home to Ukraine.
Thank you very much. My big pleasure.